This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Energy Week, episode 17, was recorded on September 25th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. If you missed episode 16 last week, we highly recommend that you check it out. We actually were the only journalist that got it right in terms of the news, which has now come out confirming everything that you heard from us last week. So we definitely encourage you to listen to last week's episode describing the potential outcome and aftermath of the attacks on Abqaiq and Quraysh, Saudi Arabia. I'll be joined this week by author and consultant Anas Alhaji, petroleum geologist Art Berman, and commercial broker Pat Hemsworth. I'll also have an important announcement about the future of the Energy Week podcast at the end of today's program. But before I introduce the panel, let's start with this week's EIA inventory data. Crude oil building 2.4 million barrels. As the market catches its breath from last week's attack on Saudi Arabia, inventory builds are back with a vengeance this week. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 2.3 million barrels. Now, it sounds tempting to think, okay, boy, that Cushing trend of Cushing drawdowns, maybe it's finally turned around. Keep in mind, as Tracy Shuchart pointed out on Twitter, that big storm in Texas last week shut in a couple of pipelines, effectively landlocking oil in Cushing, Oklahoma, and that's probably contributing to that big build in Cushing. Gasoline building 519,000 barrels. So we got builds across the board. The one exception is distillates, and it's a big one. 3 million barrel drawdown in distillates. Tape action was pretty muted in immediate reaction to the numbers coming out. Of course, it was a build, so the tape had to move down, but that only lasted for a few seconds. I think most of the selling had already occurred in anticipation of that build, and there's been a relief rally since then later this afternoon on Wednesday. U.S. production ticking up to a new all-time record high of 12.5 million barrels of U.S. domestic production, considerably more than Saudi Arabia produces. Imports, 6.4 million barrels. Exports, 3.0 million barrels. Now let's meet this week's expert panel. Art Berman is a petroleum geologist who spends most of his time drilling oil wells, but he's also become a favorite keynote speaker and consultant to investors. Art put together a slide deck for today's show. You can download it from our homepage at macrovoices.com. Just look for the download link in the description of today's episode. Art, I've noticed recently that your Twitter feed has been flooded with people arguing that the age of oil is coming to an end. They believe that shale is playing out. They know that you've been a critic of shale in the past, and they're saying, hey, alternative energy sources are coming. The era of fossil fuel dominating the global economy has already begun to wind down. What's your take, Art? Is there any truth at all to the notion that we might be witnessing the beginning of the end of the age of oil?
Absolutely none. You know, I hate to be dismissive of smart people's opinions, but I think that the reaction is a strong overreaction to what, you know, legitimately you might be able to draw from some current secular trends. But I mean, we've got, in my opinion, we are totally and irreversibly dependent on oil as our primary energy source, certainly for transportation, for many decades to come. And that's not a partisan statement, because I'm in the oil business. I like to be, or to think I'm objective. But if you look at my slide number five, I mean, this is just some very recent data that the EIA put out in its annual International Energy Overview. And these two slides are forecasts, okay? So take them for what they are. But the one on the left actually shows the major sources of energy by you know, in quadrillion British thermal units. The slide on the right is exactly the same, just showing percentage wise. And what they show, I think, is important. It's again, don't take it literally, but just as kind of a trend of where futures might go. Coal is going to decrease a little bit. Liquids are going to decrease a little bit. Renewables are going to increase to make up the difference. Natural gas and nuclear are going to stay about the same. So again, I'm not endorsing this as my view, but I think that it does summarize where we think we're going in terms of energy, which is to say that oil is going to remain, you know, at least 20-25% of our energy consumption for the next 3 or 4 decades at least. And then the issue about the shale plays, you're right, Eric. I mean, I feel incredibly uncomfortable finding myself defending the shale plays after, you know, 10 or 12 years of at least by reputation being one of their biggest critics. But, you know, again, fair is fair and we have to be objective. So slide 6, I just did a painfully tedious bottom-up analysis of the Permian Basin, which is to say using production history to estimate reserves, estimated ultimate recovery, economics, you know, the whole thing. And so what we're looking at here is this is the Bone Spring play, which is one of the three biggest plays in, you're looking at kind of the corner of New Mexico in the top half of the map, and the rest is West Texas. I looked at 5 companies in particular, Concho, Devon, EOG, Anadarko, and Mewbourne. They're the biggest producers in that play. And if you look at the tables, what it shows is that certainly for Concho, EOG, and Mewbourne, their average well, not their best well, not just this year's well, exceeds the commercial threshold of 380,000 barrels of oil equivalent. And so, you know, that's an important thing to take away. We kind of wonder, well, why did Oxy bid up against Chevron for Anadarko when their performance is not great? And the answer is, look at the last 2 years of their performance where they're averaging 600,000 barrels of oil equivalent. So they had a rocky start and figured it out. They've got some better acreage. And then the most important thing for me is, you know, people say, oh, well, all the tier one acreage is drilled up. And I ask them back on Twitter, well, what the heck is tier one? I mean, I do this bottom up work and I don't know what tier one is. How do you know? And they say, oh, well, everybody knows what that is. Okay, fine. So I'm going to define tier one as the map on the left, which is what is commercial at $55 oil. I took that area in the hot colors, which is the commercial area, measured it, came up with 1.2 million acres, counted the number of wells in it, 3,807. That's 300 acres per well. Let's just say, you know, roughly 90, 100, 110 acres per well is my very conservative estimate. Operators will tell you it's lower. What that says to me is there's lots of room for tier one infill in the Bone Spring. So, you know, that's kind of where I take it. And then finally, the slide number 7 just shows combination of EIA, IEA, OPEC demand forecasts and history. And gosh, you know, for the last 49 years, we've averaged 1.25 million barrels a day of demand growth. The estimate for 2019, depending on your source, is right in that range, 1.1 to 1.3. So again, renewables are becoming more important. Oil has not become less important. So I kind of think these concerns are a little bit emotional and a little bit exaggerated.
Well, Art, my favorite one, and I hear it a lot, is that oil is going to be replaced any day now by electricity as a new energy source. And I just don't know how to get through to people. Electricity is not an energy source. You've got to burn something to generate the electricity. So either we have a nuclear renaissance, which would be a really good idea, or that's not going to happen. And I just don't know how to get through to people. But keep trying on Twitter, Art.
I just wanted to add one final comment to your good observation, Eric, and that is all the materials that we use, not just for renewable energy, but on the planet, have to be mined. That happens with diesel. They have to be transported somewhere. That happens with diesel on ships mostly. They have to be manufactured into something. That happens with coal and natural gas. They have to be put back on ships to be sent to wherever the market is. That's diesel. They get to wherever they're going. They get put on a truck. That's diesel. If it's a wind turbine or something like that, I don't know if any of you ever seen what it looks like to put a wind turbine up. I mean, it's you got every kind of earth mover known to man out there all running on diesel. So again, just trying to be fair here, you can't separate all of these different sources of energy. They work together.
Thanks for that, Art. Let's move on to Pat Hemsworth, who is a commercial broker with Paragon Global Markets. And her decades of experience in both the paper and physical markets give her tremendous insight into dependencies which exist between those markets. Pat, I'd like to get your take. In fact, I've been dying to get your take on the market's reaction to the upcake. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Anas. Processing facility attacks last week. We saw time spreads just through the roof briefly. I thought the dislocation in time spreads on WTI was much bigger proportionately than the actual front month moved. But they've already retraced most of that move. So what are you seeing and how is this market going to adjust to the loss of Saudi spare capacity? What are you hearing in terms of what your commercial clients are doing?
Well, you know, previous weekend actually started out pretty crazy with people struggling to find out exactly what happened, exactly what was going to be affected. And, you know, you had we had a gap up opening and then it just continued through Monday. And then, as you point out, we had probably the most dramatic reaction in all of the spreads. For instance, December 19 versus June 20 went out to 510 points, which is really incredible. The DEES went out to 760 points. All of this has pretty much evaporated. But, you know, the initial reaction was a kind of panic. And we left that gap for days. And so it became a kind of really tense experience of trying to gather information, trying to understand exactly, you know, what the Saudi response would be, what the market response would be. And then gradually the picture came into better focus, you know, with the announcements from the Saudis at their press conference on Tuesday. And, you know, the market participants saw that the Saudis were actually drawing upon stocks and you know, had really made a plan with all of their buyers to either swap out some of the lighter crudes that were lost from Upcake and the adjoining field, Khurais, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, and, you know, for heavier or more sour grades. And also they announced that they would be delaying in October some of the shipments, but all in all, it appeared that their attempt to calm the market with a plan was successful. And, you know, since then, what we've seen in the marketplace, in the physical marketplace, what we've seen is, you know, more gasoline moving to the from Europe to the Middle East. And I'm sure that may have to do with some of the dislocations there. And also we hear that the Saudis were in the physical marketplace buying some naphtha. But, you know, the all in all, I would say that the perception in the physical marketplace is that although there have been some disruptions, that they're, you know, that the Saudis have this under control. The longer term picture is, you know, what is the effect of the loss of the spare capacity? How long will it take for them to completely come back? Will there be any kind of other actions that take place in the Middle East that could make things more tense and interrupt supply? You know, so these are all sort of big question marks, but for now it looks as though everything has calmed down And, you know, what we saw in the initial responses also was an exaggerated response of the Brent to WTI. You know, the spreads blew out there, and that's sort of natural because the Brent responds just more to international disruptions of supply. So so WTI Brent, we saw the time spreads correct. Today we filled the gap all the way down to 55.61. It went a little bit lower. So it looks to me like the market now is going to attempt to consolidate, and we're back to dealing with the other issues. Still, you know, there's a lot of, you know, the Saudis have to continue to be successful with drawing upon stocks, et cetera, to maintain exports, which is their goal. And, you know, but so far it looks as though we're just stabilizing here. We're attempting to stabilize at kind of slightly lower levels. And all of that excess crazy risk premium is sort of dissolving. So that's kind of how it looks right now.
Okay, thanks for that, Pat. And finally, Dr. Anas Alhaji is an author, keynote speaker, and energy markets expert. He was formerly the chief economist for NGP Energy Capital Management and also taught energy economics at the University of Oklahoma and Colorado School of Mines. Finally, Anas is the only panelist that we have who can correctly pronounce both Abqaiq and Quraish, Saudi Arabia. Anas, you've been our boots-on-the-ground correspondent reporting last week on Energy Week directly from Saudi Arabia in the immediate aftermath of the Abqaiq attacks. Now you're back home in Texas, and you've had time to assimilate the big picture. So please give us your outlook as to where we're headed from here. What is all of this going to mean for the market, for energy security, for the Suez Canal, and for the Middle Eastern region generally?
Yes, Eric, I'm glad I'm back home, and I'm also pleased that we had this podcast from Riyadh last week, and I'm pleased to report that everything reported from Riyadh at that time turned out to be correct, despite all the hype from the other side accusing the Saudis of lying and accusing them of not saying what they have to say, in a sense, correctly. So now we know today that the Saudis recovered most of their production. Everything is going toward normal production, normal capacity, etc. We've seen this reaction in oil prices, as Pat mentioned. So in a sense, it is very soon is going to be a non-event, despite the fact that it was a massive event. So for those who are interested in the details, they can go back to the podcast of last week. The things that matter right now is that we have, even if the Saudis return to full capacity and full production, we still have a problem with crude quality. And it will take time, basically, to go back to the normal crude streams before the attack. So it seems there is going to be a substitution. On the other hand, we do have other development in the Middle East. Most people heard about the demonstrations in Egypt, and people are saying, well, Sisi probably might be forced out. And this is very important development if it happens. We've seen in New York when Trump met with the GCC members for the Arab NATO, Egypt was not invited. This is a very important development. And the impact of that basically is twofold. The first one is any domestic conflict in Egypt will not affect the canal at all. I'm talking about the Suez Canal. So there will be no impact, even if we have a change of regime, the Suez Canal will not be impacted. The impact on the Suez Canal is always from problems between Egypt and other countries. So as long as it is domestic, there will be no impact on the Suez Canal at all, and therefore all shipments will not be affected. However, we might see impact on Egyptian oil production, probably for a short period. But the most important impact is, if we have a change of regime in Egypt, then we have a serious problem in Libya, because Egypt supports the Haftar and his troop, and Haftar, it was not able to take Tripoli, but that's going to affect oil in Libya, because if Haftar is not going to get enough support, most likely his troops will resort to attacking oil facilities. So a change in Egypt will most likely affect oil production in Libya, but it will not affect that much oil production in Egypt or shipments in the Suez Canal. The final comment I have on the region is that Aramco had redundancy in most fields. But what people did not notice is that they developed additional capacity, additional processing capacity in other fields that depended heavily on Bgeg. So here you go. I'm pronouncing it right here. Bgeg and Khurais. And that is where people missed, basically. It seems that Aramco was trying for the last 3 years, since people started talking about the IPO, they were trying to minimize the role of Bgeg, and they created those additional capacities because it helps with reducing political risk when they go for the IPO. And a lot of people are asking about the IPO, whether it's going to be delayed or not. At this stage, the government line is, no, it's not going to be delayed. We got to wait and see.
Thanks for that, Anas. We'll be back with the entire panel for our group discussion right after this. As we continue, I want to start with the topic that Art began with in the introductions. Art, you tell us that the age of oil is not over, and I think all of our panelists couldn't possibly agree with you more on that point. But I'm going to argue that the age of oil is changing. One of the ways that it's changing is a reaction to the attacks on Bgeg, Saudi Arabia, last week. I think just as 9/11 kind of ushered in a new era of, okay, everything changes in terms of how we think about terrorism risk, I think everything is going to change in terms of how the oil industry thinks about security risk. The other thing is, and this is something that you've done a huge amount of research on, Art, the shale revolution has just been a profound game changer in terms of the oil that it has delivered and the way that it has helped to save the economy from what some people had predicted peak oil might turn into. Well, this is a geology thing, and it's simple science. It's really, really cool that shale does what it does. But at some point, shale gets played out. There's only a certain amount of rock that geologically is compatible with this tight oil process. What's the range of how long that could last? And more importantly, at some point when it does play out, what's next? Is it Arctic offshore? How is the age of energy and the age of oil going to continue, given that there's new security risks and we know at some point the shale revolution can't last forever?
Those are all really important and difficult questions to answer, Eric, but let me give it a try here. I'm not going to address the security issue, except insofar as to agree with you that having this cushion of tight oil production, even though we all know that it's, you know, the oil quality is different and blah, 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 blah. But, you know, you just can't say, oh, well, you know, it doesn't matter that we've got 4 or 5 million barrels a day of production coming out of the U.S. from these unconventional sources. It's unquestionably done a lot to cushion the impact of these most recent attacks. If it weren't for that, then who knows what would happen. But let me step back just a bit and say, let's take a look at comparative inventory and what that says about where oil price should be. If you look at my slide number 2, this is updated as of this morning's storage report. And I've been saying this for a long time, and whether or not people pay attention is up to them. But the point of this graph, more than anything else, is to say there are two curves on it. There's a red curve and a blue curve. And the red curve was what was happening from the financial crisis through sometime in 2016 or 2017, where the world was very concerned still about the lack of new supply and the security problems that created. And therefore, the market was pricing oil at somewhere around $85 a barrel at the 5-year average. So 100, 110 when we were a little bit shy, maybe a little bit less, maybe in the 80s when we were a little bit heavy. But nonetheless, that was what the world was doing. The market was saying, we're not comfortable with the amount of supply we have, therefore the price is up. That's the red curve. As we approach the five-year average, the y-axis in 2017, all the shale oil, tight oil, had come on the market, and the market said, wait a minute, maybe we don't need $85 as the mid-cycle price. You know, we've got this new abundance, and that's the key word. And so the markets shifted the expectation down from $85 to about $65 a barrel. And that's where we've been ever since. And this curve has been remarkably successful at both tracking and predicting near-term events. So where we are right now is the yellow dot. Last week's price was almost $60 a barrel. It was right where it should be. So let's then go to the next slide, number three, in which I've tracked WTI, which is the black curve, and a number of the more favored tight oil companies, Concho, EOG, Pioneer, Diamondback, etc. And what we see there is that those stocks, for the most part, outperform WTI, which is normalized kind of in the gray, just up until oil prices got to $65 a barrel. And you can see my first data point there is 66.27. And at that point, all of a sudden, well, it was a mixed bag. They were kind of performing within the range of WTI. Oil prices got clear up to 77, 76, and now I'm talking WTI. And with the price collapse in the last part of last year, now all the oil companies are underperforming WTI. So what I would propose is going on here is not that investors are, you know, somehow really freaked out about the negative cash flow of these companies. It's just that oil prices reached investors' expectations. And how are you going to make money on an oil company if oil prices aren't going to continue to go up? And the answer is you're not. And so it's kind of as simple as that. Oil quality is an issue, but let me just say finally here that capital supply is the number one issue in maintaining abundance. And Eric, you said, you know, what are we going to do when these shale plays reach their max? Well, we're not there yet, I said in the beginning. And we can look at this in a really limited way and say there never will be another tight oil play. I don't think that's probably realistic, certainly not in the world. We already know of some big ones waiting to be developed in Russia and Canada. Argentina is currently working on the Vaca Muerta. So I think it's very short-sighted to say there won't be any more. But the main thing is capital. What this so-called shale revolution has shown more than anything else is if there's enough money to fund drilling for exploration and development, the industry is very smart and is capable of producing the results and the reserves. And I'll leave it there.
Dr. Anas Al-Haji, let's get your reactions to everything that Art said, but please also bring in the security angle to this. Is the way that the industry looks at energy security going to change materially in the wake of this event that we've just been through?
Sure. I will comment on Art's first, and then I will move to answer your question. I agree with Art on everything he said. I just would like to build on it and add the following. A well-known person basically predicted that oil demand, global oil demand will peak in 2018. Now he is saying that oil demand will peak in 2020. He is the prophet, and his followers basically are the ones who are giving Art a hard time on Twitter, basically saying that oil demand is going to collapse and therefore the oil industry is toast. But if you look at their calculations and you look at other issues, they are missing a lot. For example, if we want to talk about electric vehicles, electric vehicles right now, if you look at the numbers, what they do is they take the number of electric vehicles and they assume what they will use if they were based on gasoline or diesel. And they say, well, look, oil demand declined by 270,000 barrels a day because of the e-buses and the EVs. Well, this is absolutely the wrong calculations. You tell them, where did you get that? They say California, Los Angeles. Look at the number of buses, electric buses there. Well, in Los Angeles, all buses were running on CNG. They were running on natural gas. So how they are replacing oil? It's a pure hype. If you look at China, it's the same story. China was going for CNG and LNG, and then they stopped and they switched to electric vehicles. So to do the calculations, you have to look at two things here. First of all, how many CNG and LNG vehicles, that including buses, be replaced? It's a huge. So the replacement came for natural gas, not for oil. And then you go back to 2014 or 2015 and look at the forecast. Whatever we have changes in China right now, they are really a substitute for the natural gas program they adopted at that time. So if you are forecasting from 2014 until today, there is no impact on oil. Because we have to count, we already counted that substitution as if it was a natural gas substitution. So they are building all their view on oil based on the wrong calculations when it comes to electric vehicles. I have a column coming up next week. I hope it's next week. And in it, basically, I'm discussing the future of EVs. I think that the same people, the same politicians who are supporting electric vehicles today and providing subsidies, there will be a day when they are going to say enough is enough. So there is a maximum for the number of EVs. And I'm going to say this quickly. There are three reasons for that. The first reason is environmental. What you are going to do with tons and tons and tons of batteries, each one of them is 1,000 to 1,200 pounds of toxic materials. What we are going to do with it? We are going to bury it? Well, who is going to pay for it? We are going to recycle? Well, we don't have a technology for recycling right now. That technology does not exist. But suppose it exists, who is going to pay for it? So politicians and policymakers are facing a serious problem. So it is environmental. The second one, basically, is an energy security issue, which you asked me about energy security earlier. This is part of the answer. The United States and other countries basically went for war, several wars for oil. And they can import oil from more than 20 countries. The UK has oil. Russia has oil. The United States has oil. But if you look at the materials used in batteries, they are heavily concentrated only in five countries, whether cobalt or lithium. And the US has little of any of those. And who are the major producers? Well, those major producers basically include Russia and China. So are we going to make our transportation system, which is the backbone of our economy, a hostage to Russia and China? So those policymakers who were worried about oil for the last 50 years, they are going to be worried about the supplies of the materials for those batteries. And the third point is, and get this number, Eric, because this is kind of a very important number. The EU, the European Union, collected $540 billion, that billion with B, in 2015 in gasoline and diesel taxes. If they switch to electric vehicles, how they are going to compensate for $540 billion? So all this talk about that we are going to see a peak in oil demand or a major decline in oil demand is a complete nonsense. The other issue is, if you look at energy efficiency, and talking about fuel economy of gasoline and diesel engines, all the forecasts that include the IEA and OPEC shows that oil demand is going to decline between 8 and 12 million barrels a day in the next 20, 25 years because of fuel economy. That's a complete nonsense. We never had a decline like this, even with very strong programs with low-hanging fruit. Technology has peaked. There is no way we can achieve those objectives. So this minus 8, minus 12 is not going to happen. Let's say if it's minus 5, then we are still short 3, 4 million barrels of oil in this case. So we have serious problems. I can go on and on this to show that oil demand is going to continue to grow. But let's revert to energy security. As Art mentioned earlier, if you look at gig facilities, it's a fortified fort. There was an attack on it in 2006, and the terrorists couldn't even pass the first door because it was fortified. But it seems the industry, from an infrastructure point of view, was not able to keep up with drones, IT technology, geomatic engineering, and all that stuff. Now, how they're going to deal with it, this is a big issue. This is one risk. The other risk is cyber attacks. Now, there were a couple of people, and there was an article on Bloomberg basically saying it's time to get rid of oil because of the attacks on Gig and Grace. The oil is not a good source here. We need a more secure source like electricity. Therefore, we have to adopt EVs. What they don't know is there were historically more attacks, more terrorist attacks or trial of attacks and more cyber attacks on power plants and the grid than oil, gas, and everything else combined. So if they think that we should leave oil because there was an attack on it, like Gig, then we should leave electric vehicles too because there were attacks on power plants. So from an energy security point of view, the improvement in technology, it changed what I call the oil weapon. The oil weapon could be the oil being used as a weapon or some weapons used against oil. So we have we are in a new paradigm where the oil industry, the power industry, the grid, everything else has to be up to date on protecting them because this is really a new game.
Pat Hemsworth, you sit on a commercial brokerage desk where you hear from people who are actually moving product in the physical markets. What do you hear and what is your perspective on some of these trends and where we're headed?
Well, just one brief comment about the electric vehicle transition to electric vehicles. I mean, we really, our electric grid itself really can't handle, you know, in certain parts of the country, we can barely handle electricity providing for hot days. Like Long Island is one of the places where we just simply don't even, we have really tremendous congestion because of problems with transmission lines and inadequate ability to move power around on hot days and periods of peak demand. So I mean, you know, these are all theoretical issues that we're talking about, projected into the future, and they're important. But for me, I just think that it's very hard to imagine, you know, like replacing oil with electric vehicles on our existing grid. And I don't know when we're going to get to a point where we can support electric vehicle fleets. But anyway, that, you know, as far as what I hear every day and what, you know, people are talking about around me, people are just trying to get things done, really. And, you know, what we saw was a very, very frenzied reaction to this this event. And, you know, some of the discussion people are saying are having right now is that, are we adequately pricing the security risk in oil? Are we, you know, or are we complacent? You know, are we back to talking about demand, you know, growth erosion? So, you know, these are some of the things that people are just talking about. You know, are we being complacent? And are the prices now just not adequately reflecting a new level of geopolitical risk? I mean, there's plenty of oil capacity, but it's sort of behind a lot of political. I mean, there's capacity in Venezuela, there's capacity in Iran, there's capacity in Libya, there's capacity in Nigeria. There's plenty of oil production capacity, but, you know, it is constrained to some extent by geopolitical issues. And are we properly pricing that? So those are the sort of questions. But in the middle of those theoretical questions, people are trying to do stuff. They're rolling positions. They're hedging crude oil exposure. You know, what we saw was people pouncing on that, those rallies. You know, the production for 2020 was, you know, people were heavily selling into those spreads that we were talking about, Eric. So what I really see is people struggling to get things done in the midst of, you know, what appeared to be a chaotic and sort of scary situation. But it appears that things are calming down. But, you know, the questions remain, you know, are we adequately pricing the risk that exists in the marketplace? You know, I leave that to others. But, you know, as far as what I see and what I'm doing, we're just doing business. We're just trying to get things done and execute the hedges.
I'd like to continue our conversation and move on to the subject of U.S. energy independence, or I should say the perception of a lot of people that we suddenly have energy independence. Politicians have declared that the U.S. is now completely energy self-sufficient, which is not really true. You could make an argument, though, that North America has become much more energy self-sufficient than it ever was in the past. In the reaction to UPGEG, a lot of people were saying, hey, it doesn't matter. We got shale. We don't care about what happens in the Middle East. We don't need Saudi imports because we're producing enough oil of our own. I think there's some fallacies to these arguments, but Art, you deal with a lot of people who ask you as a consultant to talk about this idea of energy independence. We don't really need those stinking Saudis after all. Is there any truth to that? And to whatever extent it is true, how is it likely to develop in coming years?
Well, it is unquestionably true that the United States imports less crude oil now than we did a decade or so ago. And that is largely thanks to increased production of unconventional oil, both in the United States and in Canada. So let's give credit where it's due. But following on the theme of oil quality, the biggest part of that improvement in our net imports had to do with the lighter grades of oil. That's what we have. And so we effectively stopped importing those light grades of oil from other countries, which was great for us, but there are limits to how far we can go. And so when I hear people talk, and we heard a lot of it a week ago because, oh my gosh, the U.S. suddenly became a net exporter of petroleum. In other words, this is one of those one-week anomalies. And let's understand, that's not crude oil. That is everything made of crude oil and crude oil itself. So that's petroleum, refined petroleum products. So for 1 week, we actually exported more of all that stuff than we imported. Okay, good for us. That really, follows along the lines of my previous comment. However, the same week, the United States imported more than 7 million barrels of crude oil from other countries. And that same week, we exported 3 million barrels of our own. So the question for all of those people who think that we don't need Saudi Arabia or any other foreign country's oil, if our oil is so great, why are we exporting 3 million barrels a day of it? And the answer is because we can't use it to make the things we want. We can't use it in our refineries to manufacture the diesel and the other products that the United States is doing so well at, which made us for a week a net exporter. We've got to have better quality oil, or should I say heavier oil, that contains the correct ingredients, the middle distillates and heavier, that permit us to make the products that the world demands. So we're exporting 3 million barrels a day of light oil that we basically have no use for. We're importing 7 million barrels a day of heavier oil that we need to manufacture the products the world demands. And I say that is a perfectly fine situation to be in. We're a connected world. Trade is good. And we send stuff out and we buy other people's stuff. But the United States is absolutely not energy independent. We're not going to get there with Canada's help. We can obviously do a lot more to coordinate our needs, particularly for heavy oil with Canada. But I say we'll never be. I say never, it's a long time. We will probably not be anywhere close to energy self-sufficient in my lifetime. I'm old, so maybe that's maybe that's irrelevant for a lot of our listeners. But 20, 30 years into the future, we're still going to be using oil, less of it than we do today. But that is where I see us. And just to comment one more time on how we're going to replace oil with EVs. I just came back from South Africa and Zimbabwe. And I think that the obsession with EVs is kind of a rich country, rich person obsession. As I was, driving on dirt roads for countless hours in Zimbabwe, I barely saw another car outside of cities. And I promise you, I saw no Teslas, nor any electric vehicle charging stations. In fact, Zimbabwe is the only country I've ever been to that doesn't even have a national currency. I mean, you can't get cash at an ATM because they don't have a currency. So, you know, I think the people who imagine that because they see something going on in Los Angeles, that that's the way the whole world is moving, maybe they need to get a passport and go travel the rest of the world to calibrate that concept.
You know, it's amazing. The United States is arguably the richest country in the world, and yet only 36% of Americans own a passport. Dr. Anas Al-Haji most certainly does, uses it frequently. Anas, what are your reactions to Art's comments?
When we look at energy independence, when we look at the literature, when we look at everything written on this topic, the fact is, if you are importing and exporting, then your prices are reflecting the international price of oil. So you might have a lot of shale, you might be producing a lot of oil, but if something happened in Venezuela or Iran or Saudi Arabia, prices are going to go up everywhere. So you are not protected from higher prices. And if you think that you have enough supplies, think again. If you look at the hurricanes, look at Hurricane Katrina, for example, or Ivan, what happened is, we got the highest prices at that time in the state of Oklahoma, who has nothing to do with the hurricane. Why? Because prices went up in the areas where the hurricane hit, and all of a sudden, they moved that gasoline from Oklahoma to other places, and the Oklahomans got stuck with the shortages. So as long as you have import and export, if someone overseas pays more than in the United States, then that oil is going to be shipped overseas. So shale, basically, is no security unless you reimpose the export ban. So it's not only about the price. If international prices are very high, companies are going to ship that shale oil overseas because they make more money, and then we will have shortages despite the fact that we are thinking we have a lot of it. The other issue related to that is, as Art mentioned, basically, is the issue of quality. Crude quality matters. So we still need to import the proper quality that we don't have and export the quality that we don't have. But aside from those qualities, etc., President Trump, as you know, mentioned this last week when he said, in a sense, like we are no longer dependent on the Middle East or Saudi Arabia. He misunderstands what's going on in the refining sector. The largest refinery in the United States is owned by Saudi Arabia. And they are going to send their oil to their refinery no matter what. Otherwise, they need to shut down for an investment, which is the backbone, basically, of economic growth in the United States these days. Otherwise, if you look at other refineries, some of them are owned by Venezuela. So what do you do about foreign investment if you are going to say we don't need that to import oil from other countries? They bought those refineries because of that. The other related issue is related to LNG. I know LNG is not the focus, but right now we are exporting LNG to the rest of the world. We have many projects coming up online. And when we talk about natural gas market, we have abundance of gas. But if we are going to have serious problems with the LNG market, like if global demand decreases and then we cannot sell that much LNG, then those plants in Texas and Louisiana are going to back out natural gas, and the natural gas price in the United States is going to collapse. So the idea that we are isolated is a complete nonsense. We'll be affected either way by either a decline in price or higher price.
Pat Hemsworth, your reactions.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to build on such good comments, but I have to say that the quality issue is really important, as well as logistics. You can't just assume that because we have a refinery system that is very good, very efficient, and very complex, particularly in the Gulf, that we can easily ship our products all the way through the United States, or to easily pull the kinds of crudes throughout the country that we might, like, for instance, there's a lot of pipeline limitations on bringing crude from Canada. So what we're doing is we're really, the world has created a trading system that builds upon, that helps to optimize the both the inputs and the output of the refineries. And, you know, the product trade, you know, as Anas pointed out, the whole concept of the fact that we're self-contained, you know, it's crazy, particularly now that we have a the ability to export crude. But what we saw before we exported crude was a differential from domestic crude to Brent, which was $26. It was crazy. It didn't make any sense. And this is, you know, this was a result of the shale revolution. And so all this crude that we couldn't move around the country, we also couldn't fully use, and we couldn't export, was trapped. So it didn't make any sense. It was an inefficient system. So gradually what happened was we built the infrastructure to be able to export crude, which we have in place now. In fact, we have a lot of new pipeline capacity coming out of the Permian. So we have built a really kind of very sophisticated trading relationships and trading infrastructure to work for the optimal access and for the right crudes, and also to get rid of excess products. Or even, you know, in the United States, we have some regulations. Some of the listeners might know about the Jones Act. We can't really even efficiently transport gasoline fully. I mean, we can send it up the Colonial Pipeline, but we cannot economically send barges or, you know, other vessels up to the East Coast. So, you know, we have been importing from Europe and other places products into PADD 1. So it's a very dynamic world that we're living in. And as Anas said so well, you know, the prices are integrated. We're in a fully global economy, energy economy. And another example was in the summertime, California had multiple refinery outages. And, you know, it was really the height of the driving season. And so California, which also has more strict emissions standards, they have the most strict in the country, they were having difficulty accessing the right quality gasoline. And so what was happening was that it was the prices were like 50 cents, 60 cents over NYMEX. And so what happens? The supply comes in from all over the world, from India, from the Middle East, from Asia, and from Europe even. You know, so the trading system is really quite dynamic, quite integrated, and pricing is not isolated in the United States. So none of the idea of the U.S. being totally self-sufficient is a fallacy.
Art Berman, technology. A lot of people have criticized a lot of what you said. Look, Art, you're saying the shale boom's not going to solve everything for everybody, but, you know, technology is really where it's at. If it's not shale, it'll be the next thing. Technology will provide the way forward, and we're not going to run into some of the problems Art Berman thinks we're going to run into. What's your response to that?
My response, Eric, is that technology is the opiate of our civilization today, that we have so much faith in technology that doesn't even exist yet, or somebody has an idea that maybe they even piloted that tomorrow we're going to have access to it. I want to be optimistic, and I am a believer in technology, but I think we have to be very objective about the fact that technology takes a long time to go from an idea to a pilot to upscale to commercialization to adoption. And right there with what I talked about, if it's all smooth and perfectly effective, you're talking at least a decade, maybe more. So I would encourage people to calibrate their expectations of technology with the realistic schedule and history of how technologies are implemented.
Eric, I just want to add one comment to what Art said when we talk about technology. People should realize that when technology moves, it moves in all areas, not only in the area that you invest in or the area you love. The fact is, it will take electric vehicles over 30 to 40 years to replace 5 to 6 million barrels of oil. In shale, we did that all in less than 10 years. So which one is really a breakthrough technology? When you add 6 million in 10 years, or you take off 6 million in 20 to 30 years? So I think, again, looking at technology in a reasonable way is very important.
Thank you both for that. And I want to thank all of our panelists, not just Art, Pat, and Anas, but all of those who are not with us today as well. All of our panelists have done a fantastic job of making this podcast a smashing success with you, our listeners. So my hat is off to everyone for their great work. But unfortunately, we've seen relatively little interest in sponsoring Energy Week from advertisers. So we're going to take a break from producing the Energy Week podcast until the flow of donations and sponsor inquiries picks up. I'm really proud of the excellent work that our panelists have done to deliver some fantastic content to you, our listeners. But unfortunately, I can't just continue to subsidize the production costs out of my own pocket indefinitely. If your company is interested in sponsoring Energy Week, we'd love to talk to you, and we're ready to relaunch the program just as soon as we have funding in place to do so. Before we close what may be the final episode of Energy Week, if sponsors don't step up, I want to ask each of our panelists what they're going to be watching out for, not just in the coming week, but in months and years ahead. Pat Hemsworth, let's start with you. What will you be watching for as this energy market unfolds in coming weeks and months?
Well, you know, all of the topics that we talked about today in terms of how the world market responds to the geopolitical risk is something that I think is an ongoing challenge to keep up with and to watch. And, you know, I'm also looking at some of the more local things. So I've talked quite a bit on the other podcasts about PEDWAN and PES and interruptions of product flows. And, you know, and now we have some, you know, we have the IMO change in marine fuel specifications coming up, and I think that's going to be very important. And so, you know, I'm looking at the developments in refineries and to see, and also product trade to see how they will respond to this challenge. And one of the things also that, you know, I was talking to clients about today, and some analysts I know, is about the new St. Croix refinery, the new old St. Croix refinery, the old Hovensa, that it's going to be opening up at the end of this year. And, you know, we're trying to understand a little bit better about the products that they will be supplying. And I think there'll be a big bunkering center. So we will see. But that's one of the things that I'm watching, and, you know, see how the whole IMO supply chain begins to develop.
And Art Berman, what will you be watching for in weeks and months ahead?
Eric, I'm really fascinated with what I think may be a shift in U.S. consumption, particularly of gasoline. Just looking at September data, you know, what we're seeing in weekly information is a tremendous spike upward in U.S. absolute consumption for September, at least, and year over year, and compared to the 5-year average. And as you know, I've been concerned about what appears to have been a declining consumption of both gasoline and diesel. So I'm really curious to see where this goes. But I think this is important, and I need more data to confirm it. But I'm interested in seeing where it goes.
And finally, Dr. Anas Al-Haji, what will you be watching for in weeks and months ahead?
In the short term, basically, I think that applies to everyone. I think we'll be watching the Saudi oil production and exports. I just would like to mention a statement here that it is very common worldwide when you restore production that your production will decline again to allow for some maintenance and additional repairs. So we might see a dip in Saudi oil production within the next few weeks. But this is very normal. This is, by industry standards, is very normal. medium term and long term, of course, I'll be watching the impact of crude quality. Now we have a problem because of the Saudi issues. But once this is done and it's over, we will go back to the same issues of shale crude quality. This is a medium term and long term issue. And another long term issue basically is policymakers' reaction to electric vehicles. I think we are going to see large reaction. We are already seeing states in the United States increasing the fees on registration for electric vehicles to compensate for gasoline taxes. So I think this trend is going to continue.
Before we close, I'd like to personally thank Ole Hansen, Joe McMonagle, Chris Cook, and Tracy Shuchart, who have also helped to make Energy Week a great success with listeners. I really look forward to relaunching Energy Week when the funding needed to cover our production costs has been secured. Before we close, let's just quickly get the Twitter handles and contact details. Pat Hemsworth, you write a very interesting daily letter that is available to listeners. Please tell us how to follow you on Twitter and how to get the letter.
You could send me an email at phemsworth@paragonglobalmarkets.com and just tell me your interest in the energy markets and what your specific interest is. And also I'm on Twitter at phemsworth, and there I post a lot of charts and things that are happening in today that might be of interest to people, as well as other things I think that are relevant or topical.
Fantastic. ArtBerman.com is the place to go. For heaven's sakes, folks, if you have not already signed up for Art's free blog, you want to do so. What else can people find at ArtBerman.com, and what's your Twitter handle, Art?
Well, right now, Eric, ArtBerman.com is undergoing a revamp, so hold off a couple of more days before you try logging on. You'll see a whole new universe of possibilities, but please come back and see it soon. My Twitter handle is at AEBerman12, and I'm there. Even when I'm in Zimbabwe, I manage to find an internet connection and put some of my thoughts out there.
And Dr. Anas Alhaji, who's also traveling the globe pursuing the energy market. How can people follow your work?
Eric, I posted a new article on my website today on the role of Saudi spare capacity, which is going to be probably an issue in the next couple of months. And it is on anasalhaji.com, AnasAlhaji.com. I also posted that on Twitter at Anas Alhaji. And basically information, all the information on the Saudi attack and what follows and the expectations, etc., are there too.
Well, thanks to all of our panelists. And again, thanks to Ole, Joe, Chris Cook, and Tracy Shuchart, who are not with us today. Thank you, our listeners, and be sure to follow your Macro Voices feed. We're still going to have our All-Stars series as well as our regular Thursday night weekly Macro Voices podcasts. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.